Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, January 29th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, writer at the New Republic, co-host of The Politics of Everything, Alex Perrine, will join us. Also on this casual Friday, as I wear my soft-collared shirt, Francesca Fiorentini, host of The Bituation Room, will be joining us a little bit later. Meanwhile, Democrats about to give up the ghost and head forward via reconciliation, as the Republicans refuse to provide COVID relief to the American public. Johnson & Johnson will be seeking emergency FDA approval for a vaccine found to be 72% effective in the U.S., 85% effective after day 28, and 100% effective after day 49. Also effective against death after day 28. Meanwhile, Robinhood hit with a class action as Democrats tee up congressional hearings on it shutting down part of the trading of GameStop and other stocks. The post-Trump era for Republicans ends as they revisit the new Trump era. And nevertheless, pressure mounts as Marjorie Taylor Greene revealed to have blamed California wildfires on a Jewish-financed space laser. New York State Attorney General Tish James reports that the Cuomo administration undercounted COVID nursing home deaths by nearly 50%. And in D.C., the Capitol Police want to put Washington, D.C. on a form of permanent lockdown. General Motors announces they will go fully electric within 14 years, their entire fleet of cars. South Carolina passes a bill to outlaw abortions. And lastly, Austin, Texas reallocates $150 million from the police force to buy hotels for housing people. Imagine that. All this
happening.
All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. It is Casual Friday. Joining me in a very casual manner, Emma Viglin. Hello, Emma. How are you?
Cool and casual, slick, awesome, you know, just not caring about anything.
I just noticed you don't really have like a casual Friday look per se. You sort of maintain the same.
I kind of do. I mean, what am I going to do? Wear like a t-shirt with a logo on it?
I mean, that's there have been folks who have done that in the past.
Maybe I will. I mean, but we keep the windows open here, so I go with sweater when,
that's right.
When we're both in studio.
That's right.
Things
pretty
much every time.
Much more casual in the summer. I, of course, am wearing a soft-collared shirt. I think everybody probably is aware of that by this point. It is Casual Friday. We should just say that Austin is really exciting. The Austin City Council voted to purchase, this is just one example, the Texas Bungalows Hotel and Suites for $6.7 million on Tuesday night. One of several intended for emergency housing. This is from The Hill. And it is coming, the money is coming from more than $150 million in funds that it was reallocated from the Austin Police Department late last summer in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests. And astonishingly, the police department's budget is still $290 million. But the theory here is that if you provide housing for people, you are taking a part of the portfolio from the police department off their hands. They no longer have to deal with problems that emanate from people being unhoused. And particularly in the context of COVID, you're going to want to provide housing for people who might need to be quarantined. But this is a good development. And hopefully we'll see more of this around the country.
And it fits into your unburdening of the police.
Well, I mean, that's narrative. I think that was the push all along, for the most part. I mean, there was certainly, I think defund the police means different things to different people. Some people literally want to abolish police departments, but I have a feeling that the vast majority of people want there to be less policing, less, and more direct addressing of the underlying problems that society has, that police are asked in a second, third, fourth order way to address. And so this is, they're going to improve their community, Austin.
Yeah, it's nice to not have to have the philosophical discussion anymore, right? You can actually point to an example of defund in action in Austin. So we can actually move on a little bit from, I think, the spinning the wheels on this philosophical stuff that we've been doing. Austin is defunding the police, and that's what it looks like.
And in a year or two, we will get a sense of its efficacy. I mean, I imagine we're going to see the impact on people living in poverty, and obviously folks who are unhoused. We're going to see that almost immediately. But I think we'll also see, I suspect, that we will not see, you know, whatever your fear or anyone's fear would be by cutting the police department's budget by, you know, nearly a third. We will see if those come, you know, I mean, if the fear mongers about this are correct, we should theoretically see a massive spike in criminal activity in Austin, Texas. And I think in the absence of that, people can start to understand that the money is just simply better spent in other areas. And you will probably get, to the extent that there are police functions that people, I think, need, which is, you know, there are communities that are that deserve the same level of protection as other communities, not necessarily like the policing part of it, but the serve and protect part of it. And I suspect the police will find that they can do their jobs better. I mean, we will see. In the meantime, yesterday we opened the show with a clip from Nancy Pelosi, outraged that new congresswoman, freshman congresswoman, I guess you would say, Marjorie Taylor Greene from the, I think it's the 14th congressional district in Georgia. She was probably the most celebrated, as it were, QAnon believer elected to Congress in this last go round.
Yes, there were more than one.
But she was the most prominent. But
Ron McDaniel, the head of the RNC, says that QAnon is just fringe, completely out there, and yet at least two members of Congress who
at least
believe it.
Yes, I mean, and gosh knows how many people fed into this. I mean, let's face it, the QAnon fiction, if you will, conspiracy theories, drove much of the notion that the election was stolen. And we know from polling that up to 75% of Republicans believe in one form or another that Donald Trump won the election, or at least had as of a couple of weeks ago, certainly well after the election. And so I don't know. What's fringe in the what was marginal in the Republican Party 15 years ago, I think is probably arguably its leadership now. But we'll see where you know, what percentage of Republicans are QAnon like in the House, just I would imagine in two or three cycles. However, Marjorie Taylor Greene was a, I don't know how to really articulate this, a Parkland and Newtown shooting denier.
False flag.
Yes, claiming that that these things were never happened or were manufactured or something to that effect. And she was appointed by Republican leadership to the Education Committee.
Which is what outraged Nancy Pelosi.
Indeed. And, I mean, it's one thing if you want to pretend like, oh, we have no control over what our voters do. They just sort of organically came to this own notion, which is not like we stoked these fires. And they elected Marjorie Taylor Greene, and democracy calls for this. But, I mean, if you're the leader of a party and you appoint someone who denied mass shootings in an elementary and in a high school to the Education Committee, I mean, gosh.
And the premise was that they were set up in order for the Democrats to take your guns away. This is a part of the trickle-down effect of Alex Jones and all of what he perpetuated and stoked.
Well, it turns out, and it makes sense, that it wasn't just the Parkland or the Newtown that she was skeptical of actually happening. Here's Marjorie Taylor Greene. All of 3 years ago, in her car, shooting a video suggesting that the Vegas shooting was also some form of false flag operation, of course, for the same ends.
Friends, I've got a question for you. How do you get avid gun owners and people that support the Second Amendment to give up their guns and go along with anti-gun legislation? How do you do that? Maybe you accomplish that by performing a mass shooting into a crowd that is very likely to be conservative, very likely to vote Republican, very likely to be Trump supporters, very likely to be pro-Second Amendment, and very likely to own guns. You make them scared, you make them victims, and you change their mindset, and then possibly you can pass anti-gun legislation. Is that what happened in Las Vegas? Is that why the country music festival was targeted? Because those would be the people, would be the ones that we would relate to? Are they trying to terrorize our mindset and change our minds on the Second Amendment? Is that what's going on here? I have a lot of questions about that. I don't believe Stephen Paddock was a lone wolf. I don't believe that he pulled this off all by himself. And I know most of you don't either. So I am really wondering if there's a bigger motive there, and does it have to do with the Second Amendment? Because what's the best way to control the people? You have to take away their guns. So that's just my question today. This is Marjorie Greene with American Truth Seekers.
But she signed off with her name there, so we could be absolutely clear.
Yes, I think we've identified who that woman is.
Yeah. By the way, were the children, the 7-year-olds, at Newtown, were they Trump supporters too? Was that the whole reason behind that false flag operation, where none of those children were actually murdered?
I guess you got to mix it up a little bit. You got to mix it up according to her. But she's just asking questions. Just asking questions. Here she is in 2019, a little bit more, not so much inquisitive, just a little bit more definitive in her perception of what's going on. And now, you know, we hear these things, Congress people are overblown. They're trying to pretend like they're victims because they're supposedly worried about people in Congress. You know, I'd be a little bit concerned about this, too, if I was working alongside this woman in the same locale. Here she is from February 2019 in Washington, D.C., She, this is a Facebook video. Incidentally, she's been oddly getting rid of all of her social media posts. That's odd.
Shocking.
Here it is.
Yeah.
Clip number 9.
She's a traitor to our country. She's guilty of treason. She took
a... I'm sorry. She is referring to Nancy Pelosi here as she's at a rally. And so, I mean, just think about this wording and if you'd be psyched to be working alongside a person who said this, who also, you know, has a long history. This isn't just empty rhetoric. There's a lot of insanity to back this up as far as I'm concerned. But all right, start from the beginning.
She's a traitor to our country. She's guilty of treason. She took an oath to protect American citizens and uphold our laws. And she gives aid and comfort to our enemies who illegally invade our land. That's what treason is.
Exactly.
And by our law, representatives and senators can be kicked out and no longer serve in our government. And it's a crime punishable by death is what treason is. Nancy Pelosi is guilty of treason, and we want her out of our government. She's held her seat of power for 32 years. She's 78 years old. She is dying in Congress. We are fed up with these corrupt politicians that hang on to their power just to make themselves rich.
I mean, look, she says the punishment for treason is execution, and Nancy Pelosi is guilty of treason. And I mean, I frankly, with all due respect, Emma, if I saw a video of you saying this about me 2 years ago, that I was guilty of something that you thought was worthy of execution, I'd be a little uncomfortable about working in the same office as you.
I think that's unfair. No, but I mean, this woman is beyond out there, obviously. And she is the direct result of all of this online misinformation that culminated in the insurrection, that culminated in people voting for someone like this. That makes sense to them based on the Facebook videos they've seen, based on the misinformation they've heard on Alex Jones channels and other ones that are still on platforms like YouTube and things like that. So, I mean, it just got a little bit more real when voters actually responded to this kind of misinformation, this dangerous conspiracy rhetoric, and then elected someone who represented their views, how they felt about things. Like, there is no denying it. She is somebody who pretends like these hundreds of people who were slaughtered in mass shootings, like it didn't happen. I mean, she's not... It's the same thing, like you say, when like how Rush Limbaugh trained his audience to if Trump, you know, gives a wink and a nod to white supremacists, but he'll still condemn it. Oh, he has to come out and say that, right?
Right.
He has to. It's the same thing with her. But, like, she's still saying these things publicly. Imagine how she feels privately. I bet privately she's assured that they were false flags.
And the issue ultimately is not that there are individuals out there who hold nutso beliefs. The issue ultimately is that you have an entire party apparatus that refused at every juncture to not just shut down her candidacy. And obviously, you know, I think it would be undemocratic for them to come in and use extra democratic means, but to simply come out and say, this is nuts. They have cultivated a constituency, and I'm talking about the entire Republican Party, that embraces this type of belief system. Maybe it's not directly that they create these false flags things to take our guns, but they hammer home for so many years that the Democrats, that Barack Obama, were out to take their guns under by any means necessary. Well, this just follows, and they never step in. They haven't. They exploit this. Kevin McCarthy right now is down in Mar-a-Lago, kissing the ring of the former president, soon to be, or certainly a twice impeached president, as a way of saying, like, you know, we are yours. tell us what to do.
And also asking him for his help in the 2022 race to take back the Senate. I mean, to take back the House, excuse me. And we didn't even, like, get to these other videos of her. I mean, we talked about the other day of her following David Hogg, one of the survivors of the Parkland shooting, for 2 minutes and harassing him on the street. I mean, there are of her belief that her anti-Semitic belief that a space cannon started the California wildfires.
Well, to be fair, that was a space laser.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, I got my facts
financed by the Rothschilds.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of the same anti-Semitism that you were hearing about the globalists from Alex Jones. She is the Alex Jones congresswoman, and this is legitimized in the Republican Party.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Alex Perine from the New Republic about everything that's going on, not only with the impeachment, but also with the COVID relief, and how those two are in many ways intertwined. We'll be right back after this. Hey, today's show is sponsored by SunsetLakeCBD.com. I've talked about this company, about this CBD, for almost a year now, going on a year. And I got to tell you, it's a great company. They sell a great product. We've talked about the CBD tincture and how I use that for sleeping, and the CBD salve with Arnica, and that is great for your sore muscles, the smokables. All their CBD is 100% pesticide free. They use integrated pest management in their agricultural practices. They also use regenerative agricultural practices, which saves the land. They're a great business in terms of their the way they treat their workers. $15 minimum wage. This is up in Vermont, just outside of Burlington. The company is mostly employee-owned, and they genuinely care about their community. Right now, SunsetLakeCBD.com, they have been focusing on particularly their community in Aalborg, Vermont, and specifically the issue of childcare and childcare providers meeting the needs of working families. I think we've done much work on this program talking about the deficiencies that kids who do not get high quality child care, do not get pre-K when they go into elementary school, they're in a deficit situation in terms of learning. Well, children in high quality early learning environments have much, much better educational outcomes. And Sunset Lake CBD is working towards doing what they can to help their community's child care issues. So from January 20th through January 31st, so you got only 2 days left, or 3 days left here, I guess, today, tomorrow, and the next day, right? 31 days in January. Sunset Lake CBD is donating 10% of their online sales to the Aalborg Family Clubhouse. It's going to provide much-needed affordable child care in their community. They already donated $2,500 in December. So if you're contemplating getting some CBD products, you've probably bought, maybe you have the gummies and you're about to run out, or maybe you have the Sunset Lake CBD infused coffee and it's about to run out, head over there now before the end of the month, and 10% of your purchase will go towards helping those families in Aalborg. And if you use the coupon code LEFTISBEST, big fans of the show, they have been for quite some time, and they want the coupon code LEFTISBEST, one word, you get 20% off yourself. So they're really going to the mat for this, and I really appreciate this company. I appreciate their sponsorship of the show. I use their products almost daily.
And I love those gummies, gotta say.
I was on the 3,000 milligram tincture last night. So check it out, folks. SunsetLakeCBD.com. And later in the program, when we end it today and go into the fun half, we got a song from the listener Leighton Peterson. And we'll play that at the end, but it's a version of La Poupée. He's got a...
any relation to Jordan?
That would be awkward. You can check out his old band, Safe Boating, Is No Accident, at bandcamp.com, Spotify, Apple, any of that stuff. But we will play that later.
That's a funny name.
It is, isn't it?
Safe Boating Is No Accident.
And also, don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member. Join themajorityreport.com. All right. Do we have Alex?
He's joining now.
All right, great. I'd like to welcome back to the program our friend, writer at The New Republic, and co-host of The Politics of Everything, Alex Perine. Alex, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
My understanding, that's a Cyclones hat. Is that right?
That is. It's a Brooklyn Cyclones hat.
Nice.
Is that a bike in the background?
That is also a bicycle in the background, correct.
Cyclones and cycling.
Yeah. A catwalk by there, too. Very exciting. Alex, great to have you here. I went back and I looked at what you've been writing since the 8th. All of these, what's interesting about the era that we're in right now, this short period of time between when Joe Biden... It's only been president for 9 days.
Yeah.
but we have seen him issue a ton of executive orders, and most of which sort of bring us back to a certain baseline. They're nothing hugely revolutionary, although I would argue certainly for folks like immigrants and DACA recipients, really, I think, have an incredible immediate material a benefit to them. And whether it's, you know, the sort of the moratorium on deportations, we had a judge that said you can't do that, but there's really no way to enforce that. There's no way to deport everybody who theoretically you could. You're always making those determinations. So there's some real meaningful actions that he's taken with these executive orders and some that are, you know, not necessarily performative, but maybe more indicative of where the administration might go.
Yeah.
The big issue is the COVID relief bill. And simultaneously, the other issue that is sort of ongoing is impeachment. And so I think there's a relationship here in terms of like what's happening with impeachment is one of the things that's influencing the perspective of Democrats in the Senate as to whether they have a negotiating partner on the other side.
Right.
Let's talk about where the state of play is today, because it seems to have changed in the past 24 hours, or at least we're getting an indication of stuff.
I think you're right that there is a connection in the sense that it's the immediate litmus test for it's the litmus test for whether the Biden argument, where regardless of what you thought, if how sincere you thought Biden was being about the fever breaking, you know, whether or not that's actually has any hope of happening, whether like the senators can do what they really want to do, which is find their reasonable colleagues on the other side and hammer out bills with them, you know, and come to compromises that no one's happy with. I hope we'll clarify that there aren't 10 negotiating partners over there that they're going to find who are going to help with anything.
Yeah, and now you wrote a piece just a couple of days ago, I guess about a week ago, which was don't worry about Joe Manchin, because the way that we've been sort of looking at this, really, there's two issues in the Senate right now, is whether the filibuster will be quashed, and in the absence of that, or maybe also directly related to that, is Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, ostensibly to sort of like let the gates open up in terms of letting the Senate move forward and getting McConnell to agree to a resolution for new rules for the new Senate, was to come out and vow that they will not the filibuster. What?
Right.
All right. First off, give us your take on the breaking that, on the nature of that vow.
I It's not terribly surprising to hear from Joe Manchin. And I think the reason is that he has to remain committed to his, you know, most conservative Democrat line. Like, the reason I said not to worry about him in that piece was that Manchin is bad on a lot of issues, but on the things that are most important for this early part of the Biden presidency, he's not going to be the thing that stops it. He's not going to say, I don't want money for vaccines. Even when he was complaining about the checks, he very quickly qualified that by saying, of course, I just want them to be a little bit more means tested. You know, just help me out and make them a little bit more means tested, which is, you know, the
absolutely not. And then the market tanked within 2 hours.
Yes. Yeah. Like he's kind of willing to go along, but you have to be like prod him. He needs to be prodded. And I do think like in the Trump, you know, during the Trump years, like he wanted to be on the winning side of votes and he wants to be on the winning side of votes now. But then so then you get to the filibuster. And this is where I now wonder, like, all right. Manchin says, I will never, you know, I will not change my mind on the filibuster. Does that mean he is vowing to maintain this status quo of a de facto 60 vote requirement for everything? Or does that mean we have to come up with a way to allow me to go home and say, the filibuster is still in place, but then we find a way to actually have these votes? I wonder if Manchin is maybe more about preserving the filibuster as a concept whilst finding a way to actually get things done. Cinema is much more of a chaos agent. I mean, I don't like Cinema is just a chaos agent. I don't know what she wants. But my feeling is that like Manchin's going to be less of a problem than the sort of senators who I think absolutely want to spend all their time negotiating with Republicans rather than actually accomplishing things.
I want to touch that second cohort of people, you know, like the Mark Warners and the Gang 16. And apparently they have had some pretty bad news as of like sort of later in the day yesterday. But I want to get to that in a moment. But will you just and I understand what you're saying with Cinema. It's very hard to sort of like peg what she even perceives her brand is.
Yeah.
But talk a little bit more about Manchin's brand and how that impacts, because I think like people, it's hard to understand the way that senators see themselves.
Yeah.
And how they run and their relationship with their constituencies and their votes. They take votes or positions that aren't necessarily directly appealing to their constituents, but support a brand that you're trying to project.
Right. And, you know, with Manchin, it is like he needs to buck leadership and he needs to make himself sort of sell himself to people who voted for Trump because most of his state voted for Trump. And it plays out in funny ways. He in Trump's first impeachment, Manchin voted to oust him. And then within a few weeks was like talking to reporters being like, well, you know, I haven't made up my mind in the 2020 presidential election yet. You know, I'm not saying I'm going to endorse Trump, but, you know, I'm open to anything. Like, that's kind of the balance he has to strike, or at least the way he understands the balance he has to strike. I think that doesn't necessarily make him an opponent of actually doing things, because I think what he wants is just good press in West Virginia, and he wants to be able to get on TV, the local news in West Virginia, and say, like, here's what we did. Here's what we did in the Senate. So I contrast that to, you know, a Mark Warner or like a Robert Menendez in New Jersey, whose goal is actually to stop things from happening quietly. You know, like, these are the sort of Democrats who, you know, in the House, for example, wanted to keep sabotaging efforts to bring down prescription drug costs but doing it like quietly in backroom negotiations. I think that's a different variety of moderate Democrat than a kind of like Manchin, who's like, I got a lot of Trump people back home I got to appeal to. So that means like sometimes I'm going to make a big point of being like, I'm fighting my own side. But at the end of the day, it's like not actually like opposed to the Democrats passing a huge stimulus or something like that.
Well, the qualitative difference between the Democrats that you mentioned, like Warner and Menendez, is that they are even more beholden to specific industries than I would even say that Manchin is, who is doing a lot of what Sam has been saying, which is it's more of an exercise in political branding for him than it is like, I am the gatekeeper for the pharmaceutical industry when it comes to Menendez in New Jersey, or the credit card companies when it comes to Mark Warner. Like, that's a lot more of a specific goal of theirs than just a branding exercise.
Manchin has that when it comes to
coal.
Coal, yeah.
but for these negotiations, that's
right. I mean,
different.
Speak to yeah. Like, you know, there is this sense that that you know, the members of that gang of 16, essentially, particularly the Democratic ones, they want the fig leaf of compromise.
Yeah,
way of getting rid of stuff that might be really detrimental or disliked by the donor class.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the point of something like the Gang of 16 is precisely to say, like, well, sure, if the Democrats wanted to just do this on their own, there would be, you know, support for a bigger stimulus. But then, like, without having to come out and say, I oppose this, they can say, but look, like, we have to get these eight Republicans in our Gang of 16 on board. So whatever we do is going to have to be acceptable to them. The joke of it is, like, it's eight Republicans. They couldn't get two more for their phony gang. Like, eight Republicans is not enough to actually pass a 60 vote threshold anyway. But but like, it's meant to find a way for certain moderates to prevent populist things from happening without having to personally come out against them.
Can we just, I just, you know, I hadn't even occurred to me about that Gang of 16, because I'm so used to the sort of series over the past 20 years yeah. of the Four and the Gang of Three and this and that. But this is really important and really does, in many respects, give away the game.
Yeah.
If you can't get 10 Republicans to vote for your compromise, as opposed to eight or nine or seven, etc., it's worthless. It doesn't matter if you lose 58-42 in terms of trying to overturn the filibuster, or 51-49. Like, you lose either way. So if you get 10, this is an exercise in, I mean, you know, pick your word that involves you sitting at home doing nothing.
Yeah. And so then the Gang of 16 suddenly becomes the best argument for doing away with the filibuster. I mean, it's even for a group of senators that have not agreed on a compromise, but have agreed to be open to a compromise. You cannot get 10 Republicans on board to agree to be open to a future compromise. Right. So at that point, like, how, I don't know, the Gang of 16, I don't know what their theory is of how they're going to pass anything that they negotiate amongst themselves. Like, it doesn't work without, like, finding two more Republicans willing to play along.
And you can't even get two who are willing to even pretend like they're, yeah. I mean, that gives you a sense of just how, this is the old sort of construct. Like, is there a partner for peace across the, on the other side? And there clearly isn't, because you can't even get enough of them to start a negotiation, never mind come to some type of resolution. And we are seeing, it seems to me, the implications of that yesterday afternoon. I mean, I'm looking at headlines from Politico and HuffPost that basically say the Gang of 16 feels like they're stabbed in the back, but they could never deliver anyways.
Yeah, what could they deliver? I mean, I think I saw Dave Weigel make this point, but having a 50 vote majority makes it a lot easier to ignore Republicans than having a 58 vote majority. When you have a 58 vote majority, you say to yourself, well, we don't need to blow up the Senate. We just got to peel away two Republicans. And then those two Republicans can sort of sabotage everything. That's what we saw in Obama's first term. If you have 57, 58 seats, it's very easy to lie to yourself and say, we'll get three of the good Republicans on board. If you have 50 seats plus the vice president, how do you convince yourself after the last decade you will get the cooperation of 10 Republicans for anything? It's absurd.
All right. Well, so talk about, you wrote about the way forward in terms of the filibuster, which is keep the filibuster in name.
Yeah, exactly.
Reform it in such a way that as a function, it doesn't function in the same way. Just talk about a couple of different options from your perspective. We spoke to Eric Levitz about this, I guess it was yesterday. He mentioned a couple that might be more along the lines of reconciliation. Like, for instance, if you had a certain type of legislation, you only needed 50 plus one.
Yeah.
If it was healthcare, or if it was, something that Joe Manchin didn't have a problem with, like if it wasn't climate change, let's say. Yeah. But you also have a couple of ideas as well.
Yeah, and I think like the important thing is that like the filibuster is as it has worked in since basically 2009. Like it's just not sustainable. Something will change. I actually believe. Well, you know, I believe this. Harry Reid is like, it's not a matter of, it's just a matter of when it will change. I think like what we need to do is find a way to allow senators to say, like, look, the filibuster's still around. We just changed sort of the details around how it worked. And there's a history of that. That's why there's a 60-vote requirement instead of a two-thirds supermajority requirement. And then that ended up sort of, like, not working as intended. So anyway, one idea that I borrowed from... Sorry, I'm about to be annoying. One idea is to say, all right, 41 senators can block something, but they have to represent a majority of the population, which is actually like a really fun idea that I like and would run the entire Senate that way to effectively make it a more democratic institution. But the fact that it would make it more democratic is probably why the Senate would hate it. But that's from Michael Ettlinger, who is a University of New Hampshire and worked for Clinton Kane. it's a clever idea. Like you could run the whole Senate that way and then not have to like blow up the Senate to make it a democratic institution.
The best thing from the perspective of Democrats is, of course, that their 50 senators or 50 or 60 senator or whatever it is, their senators will always represent more people.
Yeah.
Likely than Republican ones. But they'll never go for that. But there were other ideas.
Yeah. This is one Norm Ornstein came up with, one that is so modest that I actually think it has a realistic shot of happening, which is basically like, as we know, the way the filibuster works now is like any senator can just block something and then you have to assemble 60 votes to end the filibuster and then vote on the legislation. His idea, which he actually came up with 2 years ago, I think, was just to sort of reverse that requirement. And then instead, the minority has to assemble 41 votes to actively block something. And if they can't do it, then a simple majority can pass a bill. It obviously does a lot less to kill the filibuster than other alternatives, but it like would definitely make it a lot more a sort of a logistical challenge and an annoyance to obstruct something if you always had to have 41 of your fellow members on the floor basically actively blocking it.
And it also holds these senators more to account, right?
Because
they're doing something proactive to stop something rather than just sort of sitting back and not helping something pass.
And also it stops the situation where, because this is one of the reasons that we got to this point, is that, you know, people started paying attention to cloture votes. I think throughout much of the 80s and 90s, a senator could get away with a cloture vote and then voting against the bill. And that was just considered normal. And then people basically began getting scored on the cloture vote. So a Republican now cannot go to their base and say, look, I voted with the Democrats on the cloture vote, but then I voted against Joe Biden's terrible stimulus plan. That just doesn't work anymore. But now, like, if you aren't asking for an affirmative vote on anything from the Republicans, they can sort of let things slide without worrying about getting destroyed a little bit more.
All right. So let's talk about this reporting that the path to compromise has basically run its course. And we now see the Democrats in the Senate and the administration start to really look towards reconciliation as mm-hmm. the vehicle for this. And it seems to me there's still time for them to say, OK, we're going to do you guys a favor and we're going to give you an opportunity to vote for, let's say, shots.
Yeah, totally.
You know, this is the shots and checks proposal from David Dayen, which is just separate out the shocks and checks, let them vote for it, because it gives them the opportunity to say to their constituents, hey, I voted for something.
Yeah.
Because and then you can maybe get a little more room to even do a little bigger reconciliation package.
Yep.
That number of 1.9 billion is out there. So if you separate off shots and the checks into one package, you might be able to get a bigger reconciliation bill, because otherwise you've got the 50 Republicans, half a dozen at least, who are up for some like tenuous elections in 2022. They're going to have to vote against that reconciliation bill, or it's going to ruin the look that Democrats did this unilaterally.
Yeah,
they're going to be voting against vaccinations.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But that's different than the shots and checks strategy, right? Because why? That you also, the flip side is, if you keep it in the massive $1.9 trillion stimulus, then you force Republicans to not have voted for those checks.
Right. But I think the idea, I mean, yes, it's sort of win-win either way politically. But the benefit of separating off the shots and checks seems to me, and Alex, I want you to weigh in on this, is you could possibly get more overall.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's right. And I think also, too, like the shots especially, like, that's needed now. And I know, like, Congress doesn't do urgency very well, but it does just seem like, for simplicity, we should just do the shots and checks ASAP. And then, because they're going to spend a month, maybe a month and a half, negotiating this reconciliation. Like, this is going to be like the big, like, you know, March vote, right? It'll be a voterama with senators doing amendments and all that stuff. That's one thing if it's like the giant stimulus package that the budget committees or whatever are going to hammer out. But like the money for vaccinations and money for direct relief, like that should just come as soon as possible. I agree that that is the correct strategy. I don't think the White House wants to do it that way, but I agree that that's the way they should be doing it.
Give me a sense of like where we are relative I guess let's shift over to impeachment for a moment, because impeachment is also like, how much is the fact that only five Republicans in the Senate now are willing to even say they want impeachment to go forward, right?
Right.
Like, never mind, they don't think he should be impeached. They don't even think it's the insurrection warrants a trial for impeachment. How much do you think that is playing on the sense that we should go through reconciliation, or we have no partners here? And there's also one other element, and it was reported yesterday that Ossoff and Warnock, Ossoff mm-hmm. I think it was reported, but both of them, that they in the Senate caucus meeting made a real big point of like, we got to deliver these checks.
Yeah.
How much does having two senators from Georgia, of all places, who won in a very isolated fashion, right? We were all paying attention to that race.
Yeah.
All paying attention to their vow about the $2,000 checks. How much does that work in the favor of those of us who want the Democrats to go big? Because I don't care where I'm from. If I'm a Democratic senator and I've got two guys from Georgia saying this is what we need.
Yeah.
They're the front line, the most front line of front line Democrats in the Senate, I would think.
Yeah.
And they're telling us to go big. How do I justify, like, I'm afraid of my constituents if I go big? How does Warner sit there and say, like, we have to stay small?
I mean, it becomes a lot harder. And I like, that's actually just in terms of the entire political debate, and especially in Congress, it's almost not recognizable from 10, 11 years ago, or even 8 or 9 years ago, right? Like, people, I think the fact that you have these two senators who have obviously are brand new to the institution and therefore don't have their sort of commitment to its tradition of comedy and all that. Like, for them, it's refreshing to hear two Southern Democrats say, like, we just want to directly deliver to our constituents. We promised we would, and now we need to keep that promise. I think it makes it a lot harder to sort of play the same delaying games and minimizing of scope games that senators like Joe Lieberman played at the beginning of Barack Obama's term. It helps that Biden's economic team seems pretty much on board with going big. There's not just like not a lot of deficit talk coming from that part of the Democratic Party right now, which is remarkable. Like, that's not what it was like during the recession at all.
Yeah, coincidentally, Joe Lieberman is in the news today for opposing abolishing the filibuster, which is just shocking. A lot of progressives.
Is it shocking?
Sarcastic as I could. I can't believe you missed that sarcasm. But anyway, a lot of progressives were concerned about the fact that Biden marketed these checks as $2,000, and really, it's just going to be making up the difference with $1,400, and that just seems like what's going to happen. I initially was concerned about it. I'm a little less concerned about the marketing now and how it's going to play, like if Republicans can twist it and say they broke their promise. Obviously, I'd like to go bigger, but what's your sense of that politically? Because Ossoff and Warnock are on the front lines talking about the urgency of it. But do you think that that's a significant schism in terms of how the Democrats push this in the runoffs and how it's actually going to play out?
I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know. Because a lot of it comes down to what we were just talking about in terms of timing, right? The longer we go from the last round of checks, like the more case there is to be made for making them larger again. You know, if it was this is the check that's going to top you off from the last one, maybe that made a lot more sense when it was maybe going to come in January, and now January's almost done. So I don't know. That's I guess would be my political case again for going larger. I feel like it's if they are going to go through a reconciliation process, they're going to sort of renegotiate all of this. I think everything's going to be on the table, but I don't know. We'll see. I think what might end up happening is $2,000 checks that are just a little bit more means tested, something like that. But like right now, I think everything's pretty up in the air.
Let's talk just a little bit about, you know, we're now into a full week into or at least a week plus into the Biden administration. And I think we had been talking about in the run up to the Biden administration that there was certainly a different feeling than during the Obama, you know, the beginning of the Obama years. And there also there's another phenomenon that I think is really interesting. And we're seeing it in terms of different picks. I mean, Merrick Garland is promoting the head of the DOJ antitrust division, a former Facebook lawyer, which obviously I think, you know, you don't have to know much about antitrust to know that Facebook is like at the top of the list to be named in that way. But it's been leaked that Garland is doing that. And there is now, again, we're seeing this play out. We've seen this play out a couple of times now where the name gets floated out there and there's pushback. And the interesting thing about this dynamic is it tells me two things. It tells me there are people in the administration who don't want the Biden administration to be like the Obama administration.
Yeah.
And they're talking to reporters about it. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that what's being clear is that there's no constituency. There's no mirror image of this.
Yeah.
There's no version of like they're looking at this sort of progressive antitrust fighter, or they're looking at, you know, Gary Gensler, and we're going to leak out that name so that the constituency for people who want more corporate in the
yes,
that dynamic's not happening.
Yeah.
And really interesting because I don't know if this is a new thing or if there's just not or it's just a function of the time. But what do you think about that dynamic?
The composition of people who make up Democratic lawmakers and the Democratic world, the composition of those people has changed significantly since 2008, 2009, and that there are left-leaning populists who not only are in the Democratic constituency or are in the Democratic caucus, but who have some power and influence within it, right? Like they aren't the marginal. We've talked about this before, but like it used to be like, okay, well, you got Dennis Kucinich. No one listens to him. he's the only one. And now it's like, you know, the fact is that, and the media treated people like Kucinich as a joke. That was an important part of it too. The press absolutely treated people like Kucinich as a complete joke. Now they actually sort of do have to take seriously, Ocasio-Cortez, and they have to take seriously these new, more progressive, more populist Democrats, because I think there's a belated recognition that they actually have a popular constituency. So anyway, that is reflected in this dynamic too, where, you know, Biden was not the first choice of this younger, more populist crowd. And so therefore, people don't feel they don't feel like we all need to get behind him to help him win. They feel like I have space to like push him in my direction. And that's a new dynamic from before. And I think so there are definitely people in the Biden administration who would like a comfortable return to 1996. Like they actually can't just sort of do that without this new populist element noticing and making noise about it.
Let me ask you one more question deserves its own, entire conversation about. But one thing I've noticed just in the past couple of days, we have this sort of attempt, I think, by Biden, by the press on some level, to sort of move into a post-Trump era for the Republicans. Yeah. And that seems to be out the window, in part because of January 6th and in part because of the way that Republicans are reacting to it. This demand and, you know, things like Marjorie Greene. But I watched Brian Williams. There's a clip of Brian Williams going around where they accidentally played, or they presumably were going to show some video of McCarthy meeting with Trump at Mar-a-Lago, and they accidentally played a clip. I don't know from what Tom
Jerry Maguire.
Jerry Maguire,
oh.
Where it's basically like he said, you know, he says, I love you. And she says, you had me, you know, at
hello.
And the idea that the media, you know, and Brian Williams is no, you know, a huge lefty. I mean, a moderate guy. I mean, literally a moderate. The idea that the mainstream media is looking at the Republicans with such a jaundiced eye is a very, very new development. I mean, you know, like without Trump a year ago, I feel like everybody would say this is the day that McCarthy finally became president.
Yeah.
And instead, in the absence of Trump, they are still on some level holding them to account. It's almost like they can't. What else can they do? Yeah. All right, let's take a quick break, and then I want you to get respond to that. All right, so yeah, respond to that notion, Alex, that the media is not, you know, like as much as they desperately, I think, wanted to.
I think, yeah.
They cannot pretend that the Republicans are normal.
Yeah. And Republicans, in a sense, are trapped. I think the media, the sort of large national political media was primed to give Republicans an out as the Trump era was ending. I think it wouldn't have been hard for a few people. And for a few people like McConnell to have made a definitive break and say, all right, we've turned the Etch-a-Sketch upside down and shaken it. And now we're back to being like the sober Republicans again. But like the fact that they actually cannot separate themselves from him is making that a lot more difficult. And then, you know, the fact that McCarthy literally could not, you know, go for more than a few days after having said Trump bore some responsibility for what happened. He couldn't hold that line for more than a few days. And, you know, it, it, makes it, it's a little surprising because like Trump, now that he's off Twitter, not on TV, it's like he kind of has, he left a vacuum in the discourse, but like Republicans are still stuck to him.
Well, that's right. He left a vacuum in the sort of general discourse, but in the Republican circles, I think it's still dominated by him. That's it for us today. We will be back on Monday with more. Alex, thanks so much for this.
Thank you.
All right, we're still sticking around. I just want to give last words. We just you know, said goodbye to our Peacock audience.
Yes.
Folks, if you missed any part of this, you can obviously watch the show on the Peacock app on the Choice channel, 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. But this is really sort of amazing. I mean, I that was the thing that really struck me about that Brian Williams segment.
How long does it last is my point. Like, how long does the fever last, I guess?
Well, how long does the fever last, or does the skepticism by the press?
I was mixing metaphors, but yes, the skepticism by the press. I just don't know.
Alex?
I don't. It depends a great deal on, I think, like Trump's continued hold on the party, right? Like if he and his kids are still like trying to dominate things and sending their lackeys around to yell at Liz Cheney and stuff like that. I think it lasts for a while. And I think the impeachment trial is going to be like another sort of albatross around their neck, depending on, because it's like the January 6th changed the way a lot of these mainstream press people think about these Republicans. The fact that they couldn't stand up to that, I think, really. And they, people like McConnell had the opportunity to, again, reset afterwards. And McConnell got some good press for definitively like being like coming out as deploring that. And then, you know, comes a few weeks later, has decided the Constitution does not allow the Senate to put Trump on trial for it.
I mean, that is the thing, is that I think what's going on is this strange dynamic where, you know, McConnell was leaking to the New York Times that he was happy that this impeachment was happening. And now, yeah, publicly insane. And it's almost like those, one of that situation where it's like, we broke up, and then after like 3 or 4 months, we got back together. And that second time that you get back together after breaking up, things get a lot more serious and real, right? Because it's like, okay, why are we doing this? At some level, like, I think the media watched the Republicans break up with Trump for a week.
Yeah.
Essentially, and then get back together with him, and that, yeah, wait a second,
they're
this
like
time,
this is a toxic relationship. I'm judging you.
Well, it's more like this is serious now. Like we thought this was, they were just dating, but yeah, now it's like they're getting married.
Yeah.
Pregnant.
Exactly. Like, this is serious. Why would you get back together with him now that he's gone? And they did. And I think the press is reacting to that. Like, I'm of the mind now where it should be, you know, Schumer should do, you know, say basically, okay, we're doing 1 day of impeachment, 2 days of impeachment in February, two days of impeachment in March, impeachment in May, 2 days of impeachment in May. We're going to drag this out for 6 months to see how long you guys are, like, how committed you are to Donald Trump. Because I think it's basically, you know, I mean,
McCarthy's enlisting his help, but for 2022, like, you know, I think McConnell made the calculation where he thought, you know, having this guy to drum up the base while he's like semi-invisible to the mainstream on his social media, with his social media presence being gone, that's helpful. We can enlist him for, you know, half-assed speeches at rallies for our congressional candidates, uh-huh, and we can try to move on from a branding exercise.
I think McConnell's terrified of it because, yeah, Donald Trump is going to be, could very well be the reason why they lose the they don't gain back the House and they lose the Senate. Because if you're, you know, like, Donald Trump, it's not like Donald Trump's going to be, you know, in 2 years going to be like, you guys did me a real solid by not voting for me for impeachment. Therefore, I'm not going to go around and support, you know, primaries against your vulnerable senators. Of course he's going to do that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And because he holds them responsible for not stealing the election for him. And he's like,
my doubts that he'll even do these rallies, though. The point is, like, I mean, he's such a wild card. I guess that my analysis there applied more to McCarthy, but like, about him using him for that. But like, I have my doubts that if there's nothing in it for Trump, why would he do any rallies for these Republicans? Why would he involve himself?
Merch sales.
And Ivanka now seriously floating the idea of primarying Rubio. So
yeah, no, I mean that's the thing to like. Yeah. Like what the sort of orbit of his family members and what they're going to, because like, you know, Trump, as we all know, like will vow revenge, but is also very lazy. But, you know, his kids are a little bit more of hustlers, and like they actually might go around making things miserable because they have really, again, no sort of commitment to strengthening the Republican Party as it is.
Well, Alex, always a pleasure. Folks can check out your podcast, I assume, in the same way that everybody checks out any...
Same way you would find any other podcast. The Politics of Everything from the New Republic.
And I can't encourage people enough to read your stuff in the New Republic. We'll, in fact, put a link to those very pieces at the New Republic. That's the most I can do.
All right. I appreciate it.
Alex, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, really Alex.
You're welcome.
All right. Now, we're not going to go into that fun half quite yet. We have another guest. I got to tell people right now that I am probably going to have to drop out shortly. I have some weird thing where I had like I had a crick in my neck that has now moved into the back of my head. So I'm like, I don't know if people notice, I've just been doing a lot of this.
Sam's in pain. I'm a little bit in pain. Yeah.
But not in so much pain that I cannot welcome Francesca Fiorentini to the show. Apparently, you are the host of the Bituation Room.
Oh, yeah, that is true. Thank you so much, Sam. I'm sorry about your neck.
Well, I appreciate that. I don't hold you to blame at all for it. I want you to know.
I do. No,
I hold Emma to blame mostly. Me second, you last. I mean, God, you're just a straight white man in a podcast world, just struggling,
you know, to keep up with Father Time.
That's right.
Father Time is the real.
Like literally, yes, exactly. I'm getting old, and the father time. I'm not convinced that it wasn't my son, sort of like trying out some new, headlock on me. How are you, Francesca?
Oh, I'm good. I'm just, trying to get this stock rally going on Claire's accessories, but no one seems to be jumping on, sexist. I truly want to figure out which store we want to. Is it Hot Topic? Is it Claire's? Is it
like somebody's on Spencer's?
Yeah, didn't that already go under?
Spencer Gift is not.
What?
Yeah, I mean, are these companies publicly tradable? Claire's is still publicly tradable.
I have no idea what that means, but you can get in on the ground level with me, Emma.
Is that where you got your ears pierced? Because that is a rite of passage for us women, is going to Claire's and having.
Absolutely. And they have to mess it up until you go back a second time. Just kidding. Your friend does it with a needle. Yeah, that is every woman's experience. And man, everyone's experience is that. What we're saying is we want to tank the stock of Claire's.
All right. Well, speaking of that, I want to play this clip of Leon Cooperman complaining about. Now, this guy is a hedge fund guy. Is he a billionaire or a multi-billionaire? I want to know how much I should take him seriously. Okay, multi-billionary. So I take him pretty seriously.
Kind of a poor rich guy.
He's a job creator.
He's in his mid to late 70s. I can't imagine if I had, never mind $3 billion, never mind $1 billion. If I had a net worth that had anything to do with an illion at the end of it, the idea that I, at age 77, I'm going on CNBC to cry about what's happening with GameStop just seems completely bizarre to me. But here he is. He's on CNBC. He is mad.
moving down the risk curve.
Yeah.
And one of these days, not today, not tomorrow, but one of these days, people are going to come in on the risk curve. And I think we have lots of issues to deal with. We have an enormous national debt to deal with. And basically, I don't think interest rates belong where they are. I mean, just think about it. We're borrowing tons of money, and taxes are likely to go up. You know, just listen to what right now President Biden is tackling the easy things. All of us want to get the virus behind us, right? So anything he does to battle the virus is universally welcome. When he starts talking about raising tax on capital gains, raising tax on ordinary income, in a recent speech, he's talked about fair share. I hate that expression with a passion. What does fair share mean? I've said in your program numerous times, basically, I'm willing to work 6 months a year for the government and 6 months for myself, which means a marginal tax rate of 50%. You live in California, Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, you're already well past that. Okay, and this fair share is a bullshit concept. It's just a way of attacking wealthy people, and you know, I think it's inappropriate. We all got to work together and pull together.
Well,
and I think that's my view.
Work together, pull together. Okay, work together, pull together. I think a lot of people would agree with that. I think there is a large cohort of people.
I just want to say this: the chances that this guy is paying an effective tax rate of 50%, I would put somewhere around like 2%.
Yeah, no.
I'm not saying his effective rate is 2%. I'm saying the chances that he's paying 50%. This guy owns, essentially, a small tax firm that figures out how he doesn't pay 50% of his income. I'm sorry. There's just no way. But continue.
A large cohort of people who are tired of seeing the system not work for them. And this
the system is not working for them. You know, it's the government that's created the policy. You know, the government is inflating financial assets. Financial assets are not owned by everyone. They're owned by wealthy people. And the government is trying to get the money back from the wealthy people by raising marginal tax rates, by creating such a low interest rate environment. But look at this way. If you're a 40% tax bracket, and I think you probably live in New Jersey, so you're probably over 50%.
Wait, he kind of stumbled onto something we would hope would happen at the end there, but that's definitely not what's happening right now.
This idea that, yes, the wealthy is getting too big of a piece of the pie, and so we're going to take some of the claw some of that back via taxes.
Yeah. Exactly, but he's not actually answering the question. I love the anchor trying to be like, "But you see, hungry people exist in the world, and do you have, sir, empathy?" Anyway, no, no. You see, the thing is, empathy is a college thing. You know, you throw that out along with you know, a couple of wives, and he's so convinced. I mean, this is the thing about this is where we're headed, you guys. We are gonna keep seeing the millionaires and billionaires unironically saying, first they came for the millionaires and I did not speak up because I was not a millionaire. Then they came for the billionaires. As my good friend, comedian Nato Green says, and then everything was pretty much okay.
Yeah.
Once we come for them, we're good. But like they're, you know, it's always about attacks on the powerful. They all the persecution complex of billionaires is incredible when they get off, you know, with, again, like you're saying, they're not paying 50% of their taxes or tax rate.
In the viral clip we played yesterday, it was spliced together with him complaining that people were getting too much cash out the door because of this COVID stimulus stuff, which is the other interesting thing, like that he's using this as, I wonder like how, because he voted for Biden. He said he voted against his pocketbook and with his heart. And I wonder if like, this is what some Democrats are hearing from the big money people, like, hey, these people have too much money and they're threatening the markets.
Yeah, Biden's going to be really tough on the market. Like, Biden is going to really crack down on what I have zero faith that that's the reality.
There's 2 points about that viral clip. One is, first off, it is impossible for a guy who has $3 billion in assets to be voting against his pocketbook. He can never know how much is in that pocketbook. That is $3 billion is such an abstraction. There is simply no way for him to expend that amount of money and be aware of it. So there's nothing that Joe Biden can do, essentially, that will change this guy's life in a material way whatsoever. We could take away two-thirds of his wealth, and he would have $1 billion. And in a million years, he would, or I should say his entire life from age 77, or if he started at zero, would he ever be aware that he lost that $2 billion except for someone holding up a sign saying, you lost two of your $3 billion? A, and B, the idea that the market is functioning this way, that this is a function of people getting checks because he read that one guy used his stimulus check to sort of, I don't know, invest in Nokia or whatever it was. The reason why the market is inflated like this is because of that CARES Act, where Treasury gave $500 billion as a backstop to the Fed. And the Fed essentially just said, we will backstop anything. We will give you corporate loans at 0% interest, all you can have, folks. This is basically an all-you-can-eat buffet. And the market just a day later was just back up and has stayed up. I mean, it's so disconnected from the what's going on in the economy at this point. Yeah. And for this guy to complain about people getting a small check, it's unbelievable.
Well, he's also complaining about the whole GameStop phenomenon, right? Because it's such an insular casino. It's not even a casino that anybody can get into, right? Like, they bar the doors if your net worth is under $1 million, if it doesn't have that alien.
Exactly.
And so, like, they're offended that their country club casino, the doors kind of got broken into and some of the plebs were able to participate for a little bit and tanked their hedge funds that were driving down again. Like, they were shorting GameStop and stock to a point that it made it their investing in GameStop toxic because they were shorting over 100% of what GameStop was even worth stock-wise. So, yeah. Like, they're allowed to do that, and regular people aren't allowed to participate in the market and, you know, maybe take a dip in the pool at the country club. It's a country club hybrid casino thing. This is my you know.
No, I mean, that's what their floating tax haven will eventually be. I just can't wait for them to get to Mars. Like, why can we, like, if they just go, or if they just create their floating tax island, whatever, everything will be fine for us. We got this. You know, but I just use your take your $3 billion. If it's real, if it's not, take it and go jump on Elon's back and ride off to safety. I'm so sick of having to deal with their whining, but you're right. I mean, I think the GameStop stuff is great. My brain wants to ignore all of it because I'm like, I hate the stock market. It's all bad, but it's true that, like, actually it exposes the fact that the entire thing has always been a casino, and they're just mad that the low rollers, you know, we know 10% of Americans own 90% of the stock. That's insane, right? These are the wealthiest Americans. And now that a few, like, yeah, low rollers with $5 got to enter into their casino, they're mad. And so exposing the entire thing. Have we talked about Claire's, though? Because, like,
I'm not convinced they're not at Mars already. I think that's where the laser is, actually. But,
you would know, Sam.
I mean, I'm not speaking out of time. I probably should have checked.
Potential email, Sam.
I should have checked at the Brotherhood room before I... folks, we're going to take a break and head into the fun half. And Emma and Francesca are going to hold down the ship because I am going to go and rest my neck or the back of my head.
Yeah, Sam's a trooper. He's been in a lot of pain.
Get, like, a lavender bean pillow.
I can't do lavender.
Yeah, no lavender.
Lavender, that would be... That's scent. That's scented. I would drive.
You know,
me crazy.
I use a lavender soap. Never know this in the studio.
Well, I got
right?
the plastic tarp here.
Oh, are you a scents and lotions lib?
Yeah.
Can you not?
One of those guys.
Oh, no.
All right. So, folks, don't forget you can support the show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Check out Nomi's show today, right after this one, 3 p.m., the youtube.com/thenomiki show and twitch.tv, the_nomiki. _show. And also check out twitch.tv/theantifada. Matt, quick, what's happening on in the Matt Lekian universe?
Yeah, we had Jen Pan of the Jacobin Show on last night. We talked about how to escape the culture war and some of this GameStop stuff.
All right.
Patreon.com/leftreckoning.
646-257-3920. Emma will take some phone calls, and we'll all be back in just a moment.